I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Forgotten and left out of the story of the partition of Ireland are the people from the counties of Donegal, Cavan, and Monaghan. These are called the Lost Counties of Ulster because they were part of the historic region of Ulster. They shared a deep attachment, heritage, and sense of belonging to a Protestant frontier community stretching back to the 16th century. Yet with the partition of Ireland, they found themselves on the wrong side of the border, merged into what became the Republic of Ireland. Only by including the Lost Counties of Ulster can we arrive at a fuller understanding of the story of partition. They are key contributors to the intercommunal violence and the failure to forge closer ties between Belfast and Dublin. They are also the victims of enduring suspicions and distrust that lasted for generations. The uprooted and displaced people from the Lost Counties who moved to Northern Ireland took their memories of past grievances with them. In doing so, they contributed to decades of intercommunal conflict known as the Troubles. The Lost Counties of Ulster and the story of the partition of Ireland in this episode of Realms of Memory. Ed Burke is an assistant professor of war since 1945 at University College Dublin. He's particularly interested in paramilitarism and loyalism on the island of Ireland. I'll be talking with him about his book, Ulster's Lost Counties, Loyalism and Paramilitarism Since 1920. So I'm coming at your book from the angle of memory. And so I'm fascinated by this whole transgenerational aspect of memory that you focus on. But I'm also really intrigued by the idea that there is a larger memory of the history of partition in Ireland. And I think the point that you're trying to make is that the memory of the people on the border, the memory of the people on the fringes, gets left out of that story. And the story of partition is a really complicated one. And maybe the way it gets remembered both within the Republic of Ireland and in Northern Ireland is a simplified version of that. I'm wrong. Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right, Rick. And I think people fall between the cracks of states. And obviously the two states we're talking about in 20th century Irish history are the British state and the Irish state. So people are very interested in the Irish Republican Army, which became, of course, you know, was part of the War of Independence between 1919 and 1921. On the UK side, of course, there's always been an interest in the Royal Irish Constabulary, the British Army, the evolution of the RIC into the Royal Ulster Constabulary, but then there's movements and there's peoples who fall between those two things. And for example, the Hibernian movement in Ireland was an extraordinarily vibrant organization in the early 20th century, but they were absolutely opposed to Republicans, to the IRA, Sinn Féin, the movement that created the Irish state. And so the Irish state never collected testimony from Hibernians. There were armed Hibernian paramilitary groups in the north of Ireland fighting against loyalists in the 1920s, but nobody ever thought to interview them. Nobody thought to collect their history. Indeed, to actually access their archives, I had to ring a Hibernian lodge which is now based in a snooker hall in the city of Derry in the north of Ireland to try and get permission to look at some of those files. So, and then on the also forgotten by. In Belfast and London were, of course, the loyalists, the Ulster loyalists of those border counties that were excluded from Northern Ireland. Of course, Ulster, the province of Ulster, was at the time of partition, 9 counties. But of course, the Ulster movement decided that they had to jettison 3 counties because the loyalist population in those counties was not strong enough, was not big enough. And so they were concerned that the Protestant assumed unionist, i.e. those who wanted to preserve the link of Britain, majority would be too thin if they included Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And so there was a certain forgetting there because there was a guilt among unionists in the new Northern Ireland that they had broken a covenant that they had literally signed with loyalists in those 3 Ulster counties that were abandoned. And so there was a kind of almost deliberate forgetting. People began to call Northern Ireland Ulster while not acknowledging that the original, you know, the original 9 of the original 9 counties in that movement that was determined to resist Irish nationalist home rule and later Irish independence, that they had essentially betrayed 3, that the 3 counties that they had left people behind the line, behind the new border.
Okay. So if you're going to add complexity to the story, one way to do this is to look at these different paramilitary groups, police forces, armies, the relationships between them, and really gets you into the complexity and surprises that you encounter along the way. So if you're looking at the period of the Irish Revolution, the Civil War, what's the significance of these different paramilitary groups, police forces that are along the border, these three counties that get left out of Northern Ireland? What role do they play in the violence during that period?
I think it's important to remember that although they were essentially betrayed, and they felt betrayed by the former leadership of the Ulster Unionism, people like Edward Carson, James Craig, who went on to be the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, that there were many who were very angry about this. And there were many in the neighbouring counties, so those counties on the border, you know, Fermanagh, Tyrone, Derry, you know, that loyalists in these counties were angry that, because they were, of course, related to people a few miles away. I mean, county lines were never, this was never supposed to be an international border. They had family connections. They knew them in terms of serving in the First World War in the same regiments together. And so rather than there being although there was a sense that they had been betrayed, there was also a strong residual support that was expressed through things like the Loyal Orders, so the Orange Order, the Royal Black Preceptory. And these were truly, you know, trans-county and then, of course, transnational in terms of the boundary, in terms of the border. And so loyalists during the initial period of the War of Independence were, of course, you know, very angry in these counties that they had been excluded from the new Northern Ireland. But they also felt that there was something worth fighting for, and that was to maintain some connection with Britain and the wider empire, and indeed, of course, with Northern Ireland. And so what we see then, surprisingly, to some extent, is that rather than simply just giving up, that particularly in you know, places like East Donegal, but also in North Monaghan, that loyalists organize here paramilitary networks. They are active in terms of, in Donegal, they support the loyalists in the city of Derry. Derry has an Irish nationalist majority. So loyalists actually from Donegal, which has been excluded from Northern Ireland a few months previously, come to the aid of unionists in Derry when it looks like the city might even fall to a Republican attack in June 1920. In Monaghan, loyalists there actually inflict, you know, a significant amount of casualties on IRA volunteers, IRA insurgents in the county in 1920 and 1921, and kill a number of IRA volunteers as well. And they really are, you know, instrumental in terms of allowing, by the summer of 1921, the police believe in Monaghan that they are turning the tide against the IRA. And they are, you know, it is clear that loyalists play an important role in this, that they organize vigilante groups, that they impose curfews in certain parts of the county. And of course, what they're holding out for is to some extent, they get an element of it in that the Anglo-Irish Treaty does not create an Irish Republic. It creates a dominion of the British Empire. And so they then believe that, you know, it's not been a complete resounding victory for Irish Republicans, that there's been, this is a compromise, and they can maintain a British identity in a dominion of the British Empire. That, you know, arguably with the benefit of hindsight, that is somewhat naive, in that it was difficult to have overt expressions of Britishness within these counties. But really, the final blow for their identity did not come until Ireland became a republic in 1949. And of course, there were many people, many of the forgotten county loyalists, or the lost county loyalists, as they call themselves, felt that was a profound betrayal of the treaty, and that they had taken away their formal British identity, which was enshrined in the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921. And there was indeed, in the early 1950s, partly for economic reasons, Ireland was going through a severe economic depression at the time, but also for political identity reasons, there's a major influx of loyalists from the three counties into Northern Ireland in the 1950s.
So you could argue that if there's a forgetting, there are multiple forgettings in the story, there's a forgetting of the role that they played during the revolution, during the Civil War, that If you look at places like Moynihan, they stemmed the advance of the IRA. If you look at places like Derry, they reversed the fortunes of the IRA in the city. And I think you also point out that there are people who are migrating into the north early on from these border counties during the 1920s. And there's a larger, longer tradition of people who are joining police forces, paramilitary groups in the north. And they are really fueling the violence in the north during the 1920s. And playing a political role in shaping relations between Belfast and Dublin. And I think that role has also been kind of left out of the larger story.
Yeah, it has.
That ties in with the McMahon murder story.
It does, because, I mean, it's interesting to see that the radicals in Belfast in the 1920s, the most prominent of them are from the Lost Counties, as they called it, and it's because when they moved to Belfast, or when they found that the Ulster Covenant, of course, this protestation of Ulsterness, that Ulster was somehow separate, it was a different ethnos, there was a different almost quasi national identity, that meant that they should be excluded from Irish Home Rule, being governed by Dublin, or indeed, of course, by any new state. That when this betrayal happened, this betrayal of the Covenant happened in 1920, the major critics of the new Northern Irish government were from, particularly from County Cavan, actually, was one of the counties. And so you had William Coote, who was a real thorn in the side of James Craig. And every time it looked like Craig, under pressure from the British government, was going to compromise with the new Irish government, the new provisional government of the new Free State of Ireland in Dublin, Coote was quick to use loyalist militants to torpedo that. So you had a pact between James Craig and the chairman of the provisional government, the former IRA intelligence leader, and now the leader of this transitional government, Michael Collins. They deliberately escalated. He allied himself with paramilitary groups like the Ulster Imperial Guards, and used militancy, used violence in terms of street, violence in Belfast, particularly against nationalist areas, as a means of torpedoing any move towards conciliatory agreements that he and other militants didn't approve of. And of course, the at the forefront of what was becoming a politicized police force in 1921-22 was John Nixon, who was a district inspector in West Belfast and had a support base in the Loyalist Shankill Road. He was from County Cavan as well, and was particularly angered at the treaty breakers, as he called them, covenant breakers, James Craig. And he then later was eventually dismissed from the police. I mean, Craig was fearful of his power in terms of the power of his loyalist militants, paramilitaries, with whom Nixon was working together with Coote, who was a family friend from County Cavan. And they only dismiss him from the police in 1924, and then he becomes an MP, and in some ways is the major working class loyalist opposition to Craig throughout the rest of Craig's premiership, right up until the 1940s. Indeed, he remains a very vociferous critic and really a sort of a guardian against any conciliation towards Irish nationalism. There is an alliance between people from the Lost Counties and then working class loyalists who are more associated with the trade unionist movement, but a trade unionist movement that is inherently sectarian. It is, for Protestant workers, and wants to privilege Protestant workers over, so-called disloyal, which, read for that, Catholic workers. And so often called the kind of crimson loyalism, a bit of red, a bit of orange. And so it's the people from behind the Lost Counties militants who really, who are playing a leading role in this, and they continue to do so for much of the rest of the 20th century. Again, in the 1970s, we see that in things like Ulster Vanguard, which successfully brings down the first power sharing government in Northern Ireland, which was established under the Sunningdale Agreement, the Sunningdale Executive. which collapses in the May of 1974. Again, it's people from the Lost Counties who are at the forefront of this, warning against any conciliation. They point out to the people of Northern Ireland that we can tell you what awaits for you if you conciliate, and this Sunningdale Agreement is only a Dublin away, is kind of the slogan that they use. And so people like Ernie Baird, who's the deputy head of the Ulster Vanguard movement in 1974, but indeed its head as well, the leader of it, Bill Craig, who had grown up in County Cavan, they use that experience sometimes to an exaggerated effect, it should be said. They used it to try and make the Ulster movement, the Ulster Unionist Party, more militant and to again warn against any compromise with Dublin.
Okay. But you have that kind of repeated history of displaced people who leave these border counties, bring their memories, the memories of grievances with them, that it seems like in the 1920s, it really fuels the intercommunal violence and maybe prevents a kind of what could have been closer ties between Dublin and Belfast. There were attempts to achieve that with that particular pact that you mentioned earlier unraveled because of the violence. And then later on, it's a kind of repeat thing with the new wave of migrants who come in the 1950s who tend to orient themselves towards the kind of the hard right.
We very much have a pattern of that. And even today we have, Jim Allister, who's the leader of the kind of militant traditional unionist voice, which is, always been very anti the kind of the power sharing executive that we have today in Northern Ireland. That's his family are from County Monaghan and moved to Northern Ireland in the 1950s when Jim Allister said his father, said that the quote unquote the noose was tightening. He again uses that experience as a means of expressing, why conciliation with the South, with the Irish state, is simply not only unwise but dangerous, that there is no place for Ulster unionists, for Ulster loyalists within an Irish state, that the experience has been a bitter one. The very very much a pattern there. And of course, when there was, particularly from the 1950s until the 1980s, there was a real significant downward trend in the population of Protestants in the three counties that I talked about, Donegal, Cavan, and Monaghan. You've kind of relative to 1911, so there's essentially, sort of half the proportion of the population by the end of the century that there. So there's a real migration pattern from the 1950s onwards, and of course that's also deeply resented by nationalist Catholics in border counties in Northern Ireland who feel that these people are being privileged over them, and that this is another example of a gerrymandering of how Northern Ireland is essentially a sectarian statelet that excludes them from social housing and other things and privileges people from across the border in the Republic of Ireland who are Ulster loyalists, who are lost loyalists essentially, who are now being welcomed into the fold of Northern Ireland. So it creates resentment, it creates suspicion, because of course for every migrant that moves across the border a few miles, sometimes maybe just a mile or two, of course they leave many people, cousins, brothers, sisters behind, when the troubles break out then in 1969, there is then a pattern of suspicion based on first of all, an intergenerational aspect, because loyalists in a place like Monaghan were not defeated in 1921, there is then a memory of those families who are most active in loyalist resistance in a previous generation. And then, of course, because so many people from these counties have joined the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the police in Northern Ireland, actually the share of police recruitment from the three counties after partition grows in terms of, so if you compare the RIC and RUC, the Royal Irish Constabulary and the Royal Ulster Constabulary, you actually see that, there seems to be relative to the overall recruitment in the Royal Ulster Constabulary, actually the proportion of Protestants from the three counties joining that is higher than the you know, is higher than the those in if you look at the Ulster recruitment patterns for the RIC previously, it seems that there's actually even an increase for a period. So there's clearly the border has not affected police recruitment in terms of recruitment of Protestants or Swile, at least, you know, people who identified as loyalists to the police. And after partition, there's as I say, there's very little effect on that. In fact, it seems to be even an increase in police recruitment from the Protestant communities for the Royal Ulster Constabulary in Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, you know, in terms of the 7,000 Gardaí who are in the Irish state in 1972, only 18 are Protestant. We have, you know, 12 members of the RUC come from one Donegal parish alone in that year, around that time, I should say. So it's you know, obviously people are still looking to Belfast even after 1921 for a very long time when it comes to sections of the Protestant communities in the three counties. And of course, there's the loyal orders which continue and are, and all Ireland, it, you know, the Orange Order is an all Ireland, all Ireland organization, but it is particularly and exceptionally strong in the three Ulster counties that are in the Irish state.
But these are long established traditions, right? These lodges, the participation in the police or other groups in the north by these border Protestants, they're traditions that don't work. By the time you get to the with the 1960s, they're looked at, or maybe even earlier, they're looked at much more suspiciously. And I think your point is that my understanding was that these three lost county Protestants, they kind of had a broader understanding of identity, of belonging, and they get kind of stuck within these narrower national frameworks, and they kind of continue traditions that predate those frameworks, but they don't work anymore in the newer political context, and they're just seen as untrustworthy.
Yeah, and you know, there were moments when it came to things like in the late 19th century with, you know, land agitation and land reform, when actually, you know, members of the Orange Order were sympathetic to the these are somewhat brief periods, but there are moments when, you know, before independence, when, you know, loyalists and nationalists have, you know, similar socioeconomic demands. There are also times when, you know, the British state in the 19th century suppresses the Orange Order. I think, you know, one of the issues with creating, you know, Northern Ireland and indeed the Irish state is of course, that, you know, the Orange Order is now, you know, fully identified with Belfast, which now has a government. Whereas, you know, previously, yes, they were loyal orders, but at the same time, they often had highly contentious relationships with the British state, who, you know, various points even outlawed them in the mid 19th century. So suddenly having this, I mean, what people on the border used to refer to Belfast in the mid 20th century was, you know, Northern Ireland was sometimes the shorthand for it was Orange, right? Which is a kind of crude, but often used, a way of describing Northern Ireland. And then, so it was fully identified with the wider Orange movement, and indeed the Orange Order had a place in the Ulster Unionist Council and had a voting rights, etc. So that created just, it locked these identities into, you know, into official state entities. And then you had, of course, the Irish state then, you know, in terms of particularly in the mid 20th century went through a particularly, even though it guaranteed rights constitutionally for people from minority religions, etc. And, you know, so there's a lot constitutionally to celebrate there in terms of the, you know, the rights that were given to minorities. At the same time, you could not but look at, you know, the Irish state and not very quickly appreciate how inherently Catholic, you know, the identity of various governments and government ministers, and even the way that state ceremonies were held, there was an inherent sort of Catholicism that was never far away there. So, of course, that meant that, you know, particularly after 1949, that, you know, Protestant loyalists from the Ulster counties as well were, you know, this unusual area of Protestant strength, and of course, with a a longer standing sense of Ulsterness, if you'd like, that they felt increasingly distanced from Dublin and from the state. And it didn't mean that there was a lot of pragmatism there in terms of working on local issues, whether it comes to, you know, farming issues, when it comes to economic issues. And of course, there was always a cordial, you know, relationship in these rural counties between neighbors. You know, we shouldn't in any way exaggerate in terms of the often, yes, there were very separate social spheres, from schools to, you know, even to sports organizations. Generally in border counties, you know, Protestants often didn't identify with the Irish language, for example, which is seen as part of a nationalist or Republican sort of movement. But nonetheless, there was a cordiality there, and there was a kind of a rural, for all the political and social structure differences, there was also, we shouldn't underestimate the tolerance that was also there. That meant that what I write about in my book is not the entire story of Protestantism in the three counties. It's the story of people who held fast to the old ways after partition. And that wasn't everybody. It was a large proportion of people in the three counties. And then, of course, among people who remained loyal, there were, of course, those who were much more militant, some of whom were moved to Northern Ireland, of course, and even went so far as to join paramilitary organizations in the more recent Troubles. So I think it's a complex story, but it's something which has been overlooked, partly because, again, as I say, neither Belfast and Dublin, I think both Belfast and Dublin, in terms of the governments, found it difficult to talk about. The Irish government was, in some ways, to acknowledge an Ulster Scots community that had longstanding loyalist political beliefs and tenets acknowledging that you have this what is really an ethnic minority, you know, people who have a strong sense of their Ulster Scots, their British, well, you can call it Scots Irish or Ulster Scots, that this is something that is distinctive within the Irish state, that it's dissimilar to it. There are differences between Irish Scots, Ulster Scots, Protestants in Donegal, and then perhaps the Protestant experience in other parts of the Irish state. And only recently, really, with the setting up of the Ulster Scots Agency, which was really pushed for by the Unionist in Belfast and supported by the British government, have we seen, you know, funding and more initiatives that celebrate Ulster Scots heritage within places like, because Donegal has this particular concentration of, you know, Ulster Scots culture, language, etc. And so that was only reluctantly in recent years, really, that the Irish state has kind of moved to accommodate this. And I think there's been a lot of very good things in recent years since, in terms of, you know, the recent governments embracing that. But it took a long, long time.
It's hard not to think of Australia. Maybe Ireland is moving more towards a multicultural political framework that took some time to get there.
It certainly did. I think also the some of the limitations were, of course, that, you know, many people in these counties looked at, you know, in some ways the Irish Revolution compared to other European revolutions was, of course, quite a gentle one, because there was no great land redistribution in the 1920s. So, you know, the Protestant population in Monaghan or in Donegal were generally better off, you know, than their Catholic neighbours in terms of, you know, the things like, you know, the size of farms or, you know, etc. So there was a kind of sense that, you know, in terms of that is a difference, that in fact nationalists in these counties felt that they had shown quite a lot of tolerance by not sort of carving up lands from, you know, loyalists who now found themselves living in what became a republic. And So rather than feeling that they had badly treated kind of Ulster loyalists in the Irish state, they generally felt that they had, you know, been generous and that they had, you know, they had civil liberties enshrined in the constitution, that Protestant schools were funded by the state, etc. And of course that is true. That's all true. There was, relative to other European kind of ethnic, you know, tensions or conflicts, this is not the Balkans. But at the same time, of course, when it came to just acknowledging that sort of that identity that people in Donegal from an Ulster Scots background feel that they are very distinctive, and that they also have things in common, of course, with you know, they view themselves as Irish, of course, but they also have this kind of this rather distinctive experience that they believe for many years the Irish state has, of course, been very reluctant to acknowledge, because it would have created complexities. The idea of the Republic, of course, going back to, you know, 1798 Wolfe Tone, is that it's a bit like France in terms of, you know, suppressing for a long period. You know, in France, it was the idea that everyone should just be citizens and speak French. And, you know, so similarly, the Irish Republic was designed around, you know, that we are all simply Protestant, you know, that dissenter, Catholic, etc., you know, can all be good Republicans. And, but of course, inherent to the idea of Ulster is loyalty. That the Ulster identity was created in the late, was in many ways, there was long-standing sense of Ulsterness before even the 19th century. But in the late 19th century, it was bound up with this idea of separateness and Protestantism and exclusivity. And so for the Irish state to warm to that, or to sort of acknowledge that, was, of course, went against all its political instincts.
Yeah. So I think you make that point. There's this historic identity, and how do you incorporate that into the new nation? Maybe culturally it doesn't happen. You get maybe a homogenized Catholic kind of nation that takes shape, but at the same time, you get rights that are protected. You don't get land that gets expropriated. So there's a place that maybe for Protestants to remain in Ireland, but at the same time, there's still kind of a suspect population. I think one of the things you stress is that as late as the 1970s, you get people who are completely like assimilated into the Republic of Ireland, who have high positions in government, but there's still suspicions and rumors circulating that go back to the 1920s. And I was hoping you could talk about the case of Billy Fox as an example of that, that you get somebody who really has nothing to do with loyalism, but he finds himself suspect of it.
Yeah.
What happens with him?
Yeah. But Billy Fox is in many ways everything a young Republican hoped for, right? He's living with in South Monaghan near the border with his uncle, who has, you know, signed the Ulster Covenant, right? So in 1912, and yet he is dedicated to the new Republic. So he has completely turned his back on the beliefs, the political beliefs and identity of his, you know, his parents and his grandparents. He has decided that he's determined to make the new Republic work. And to take it, you know, at face value, that this is a place for Protestants. It will, you know, protect the rights of Protestants, and he's every much an Irishman as anybody else. And indeed, you know, that was always the kind of the Wolfe Tone ideal of 1798. Now, of course, we know in the 19th century that, you know, Catholicism and Irish nationalism were very intertwined, and Daniel O'Connell was keen, the great liberator, was, you know, one of the people who very often made that point about the sort of the Catholicism was in the Irish DNA. Others, of course, you know, so there was always a tension there. But Billy Fox is determined that, you know, he is a citizen of the Republic, and he's going to get into public office and make his country work as best he can as a public representative. So he's elected as a member of Parliament, as a TD to the Dáil in the late 1960s, 1969. And then he is, he is, however, repeatedly slandered, because by people. He's a member of a party called Fine Gael, the opposition party Fianna Fáil. There are people like P.J. Lenihan, who is a TD who was in the Republican movement in the 1920s and had worked as a teacher in Belfast, who, you know, slander him as essentially a member of a loyalist who's a member of the Auxiliary Police Service, the Ulster Special Constabulary. He gets you know, repeatedly slandered, including in Parliament, for being, you know, a B special, again, you know, a covert police officer or spy working for Northern Ireland. He's, you know, profoundly hurt and angry about this, but it just keeps happening, and he. He is. When he campaigns for re-election in the early 1970s, he's. There are signs put up around Monaghan, you know, saying that he is, again, disloyal, he's a traitor, and he's a member of the B Specials. Now, ultimately, this is something that obviously that the Troubles has kind of brought back. So 1969 violence, breaks out in Belfast and Derry, and then that leads to the intervention of the British Army. And we now have, by 1973, we have a sort of full-scale conflict, an insurgency by the Provisional IRA. Obviously, we've got loyalist paramilitary groups who are carrying out cross-border attacks. And so this is really a time of, you know, great tension, great anger in throughout, not only Northern Ireland, but also particularly in the border communities. And Fox is in many ways collateral damage of that. So he's engaged to marry a local Monaghan girl called a Protestant called Marjorie Coulson. And Coulson's have a good sized farm just outside the town of Clonus on the border. They have Fermanagh roots going back to the 19th century, but they've lived in Monaghan for a very long time. And it's put around Republican circles that the Coulsons are actually the quartermasters, that they are keeping weapons for the Ulster Volunteer Force, which is a paramilitary terrorist organization in Northern Ireland. And ultimately, the Republicans, the IRA, are really angry in the area because loyalists have successfully carried out a number of cross-border raids to targeting IRA safe houses and indeed IRA arms dumps. So they've obviously got good intelligence. Now, rather than suspecting that this might be passed from the police, from the Irish police force, the Garda, to the Royal Ulster Constabulary, they believe that there's a fifth column at work. And so they decide to raid the Coulson's house to, you know, find evidence of this. When they raid the farmhouse, they don't find weapons. Ultimately, they decide to burn the house down. And during the raid, Billy Fox arrives. So this is March 1974, and he arrives at the house to visit his girlfriend. He's stopped by the IRA, by the IRA raiders. He basically runs from the car. They pursue him into a field, and then they shoot him dead. It just creates an absolute reverberation of fear throughout the Protestant community in the border area, because it's not believed that they shot him by accident. It's believed that they would have recognized Billy Fox and that they decided to kill him anyway, for reasons that are unknown, you know. But again, the tension and the fear that a sectarianism might be creeping into, and that, you know, ultimately that there'll be future violence, future burnings of Protestant farms, future killings is really strong at that time. And in some ways, you know, Billy Fox, arguably one of the reasons that he's so slandered is because some local IRA volunteers from the 1920s seem to misremember. There's a mismemory of the Fox family's role in the 1920s. It's alleged that Fox's grandfather was the primary kind of, you know, UVF leader in his local area of Bawn. But in fact, it's another another George Fox. There are two George Fox in the area, and his grandfather is George Fox from a place called Cortubber. And then very nearby, there's another George Fox who is of Corlay, which is the primary Orange loyalist leader in the area. And so this kind of misremembering, you know, has a real effect in terms of the some of the slander against Fox 50 years later. And, you know, arguably sort of caused so much tensions around him and, during his time in political office and before his death.
So it seems like in the North, you have people who find political capital in the Ulster past, in the three lost county past, even if they have to manipulate that past, even if they make up hardships that never existed, right? And then in the people who remain in Ireland who might want to distance themselves from that past are stuck with it and maybe become victims of it.
It's true, and arguably it doesn't help that the in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, rather than being sort of cowed by the new state and turning away from former leaders of the paramilitary organization, the Ulster Volunteer Force, which again had been formed to resist home rule around 1912, 13, 14, that rather than turning away from these figures, that, you know, people in the three counties in the Irish state tend to elect them as to positions of influence. So in Monaghan, as an example, they elect Alex Hazlitt, who's been a UVF officer in the 1920s. You know, there is they similarly in Donegal, they also elect a local UVF commander. So in some ways, it's you know, that's why Fox is so different, is because he and others and try and distance themselves, but they find it very difficult in one generation to do that. And then, of course, there are others who are leaving the three counties, then going to Northern Ireland, where they seem to join the more militant political movements. So you've got Jim Kilfedder, whose mother is from Donegal. And when he starts speaking out about condemning the IRA, etc., you know, his mother's family home in Donegal is burned down. And indeed, you know, the IRA later actually kill target his cousin and kill his cousin's wife in a bomb attack, and they're living on the border just inside Northern Ireland. But again, is that really sort of shakes the kind of community, border community of loyalists, but also, you know, Protestants in across the border in Donegal as well. So it's seen as it's a profoundly difficult time because those who wish to move on are sort of, as you say, are constantly sort of dragged back into the identities of their parents or their grandparents. And then those who move to Northern Ireland are often those who have grievances. You know, there's people who believe that they have been treated badly, that they're that they have been slandered, that they can't. And then in some ways, this is often articulated by, you know, by a significant number of people moving and joining and voting for more militant movements. I mean, border loyalists anyway in counties like Fermanagh and Tyrone, these are just across the border, these counties, and they tend to be the more militant unionists. They're much more militant in some ways than the Ulster unionists in places like County Down are, and they tend to look upon the Irish state with great fear, even if they have, you know, good, often cordial relations with, again, their neighbours. But they tend to view, they don't see any room for compromise, and they're very adamant about that. And it's interesting to see that, you know, a number of, when you look at, for example, in 1972, again, those who move north often just move a few miles. So the Ulster Defence Regiment of County Fermanagh, which is this part-time British Army regiment made up of people from Northern Ireland who are want to kind of contribute to the defence of Northern Ireland, and it tends to recruit, you know, overwhelmingly from the Protestant community. I mean, ultimately in 1972, the 4th Battalion, County Fermanagh Battalion of the Ulster Defence Regiment, they decide they have to move a number of part-time soldiers out of an exposed area in southwest Fermanagh. You know, of these families, you know, only one isn't originally from the Republic of Ireland. So, you know, they've moved only a few miles. They've then, they bring stories with them of what they feel is grievance. They feel that the Irish state in the 1950s particularly had turned, you know, quite overtly very less tolerant and had become more, you know, more Catholic and less tolerant. And of course, they didn't have this Commonwealth link anymore. So when they move across the border, they tend to, you know, they bring some stories of harassment and, you know, I mean, harassment is, as I say, they have complicated, because in some ways they have, you know, they often say how they get on so well with some neighbors, but there was certainly a political undercurrent there that was difficult for them. And so when they move, you know, they bring these stories of often of harassment or of certainly of a bitter experience in the South. One of the reasons they leave, and then they find themselves being forced to leave again. So when they cross the border because of the attacks in the border areas. So people who are born in Donegal or people who are born in Cavan and then move to Fermanagh are forced to move deeper into Northern Ireland. And similarly for some Monaghan people who were born in Monaghan and then have moved to Armagh, you know, some people again are forced to move further away from the border just for security reasons. So this obviously breeds quite a lot of resentment. And I think it's often expressed politically then in terms of some of their representatives talking about this and indeed getting political traction out of it. So I mentioned Jim Kilfedder, for example, Ernie Baird, you know, they all talk about these experiences and and they very much get their, you know, they get support for it among militant loyalists, but also among the, you know, significant population who are born in the South who've moved to the North.
Those three county Protestants that do move to the North, is there an intentional policy to settle these people in nationalist stronghold areas?
The Orange Order, which again is closely tied to and associated with the Ulster Unionist Party, certainly has a policy towards that. That, you know, it is, they want to encourage people who are moving to, first of all, they want to encourage people from the South to come to the North, because there is this view expressed by, you know, most consistently by Basil Brooke, who's Prime Minister of Northern Ireland in the 1940s and 50s, that ultimately Northern Ireland is like a lager. And that, you know, there's nothing they can do for Donegal loyalists or Monaghan loyalists, that they should just come in and then they should defend the border. That should be, they are frontier loyalists and they have a proud frontier history. They've lived and survived in the most difficult part of Ulster in terms of being a political minority, and that they should come now to Fermanagh, which is, you know, has a nationalist majority, but is to Brooke and others is an integral part of Northern Ireland, and they should settle there. And that really angers people in, you know, Catholic nationalists in Fermanagh, who believes that they're, you know, that ultimately that Catholic nationalists are being frozen out of social services, public jobs. You know, they're not employed, but there's discrimination in public employment, and that's certainly, there's significant evidence to show that. And that they feel that there is encouragement. And indeed, you know, I think the record archives show that the Orange Order is eager to do this, and actually has a special land fund to allow for this. So certainly, yes. I mean, that's why when you look at the Ulster Defence Regiment in, you know, membership in right on the border, such a significant amount of people there, as I say, are born in the Republic of Ireland.
So isn't that part of the backdrop of the Caledon situation, right? Housing policy and the decisions of where you settle these people and the problems that grow out of that. I mean, I don't know whether, can you argue that that's the beginning of the second round of the Troubles? I mean, can you tie the three county loyalists as part of the origins of the second round of Troubles? I mean, that really hasn't gotten much recognition in how that history has typically been told.
Yeah, no, I think there's something in that. I think there's something in this, in terms of looking at a kind of a long war, essentially, because there's movements on both sides of the border, right? So there's people who are, you know, the Catholics in Fermanagh feel that, you know, that they are forced to migrate in larger numbers because of lack of economic opportunities, that they're bringing Protestants in from the South. This is causing, obviously, social tensions, which feeds into the civil rights movement. It's a largely Catholic movement with some Protestant support among sort of moderate unionists or people involved in trade union movements, etc., student movements. And there is a kind of sense that this has been, this movement of populations across the preceding decades has exacerbated tensions. And so Caledon, this is a protest in a very small village right on the border, you know, just across from Monaghan in Northern Ireland, that is about a very public decision, particularly by Austin Curry, who's a Tyrone MP in Northern Ireland, a nationalist MP, who decides to take a stand in a very public stand, drawing upon the example of the civil rights movement in the United States. And what he was unaware of is, of course, that Caledon, for that many Protestants in Caledon, which is a small village, there is indeed discrimination against Catholics into the allocation of social housing. And that is, you know, this can't justify that. But of course, for them, in terms of their mindset, is that a number of families have come from County Monaghan. And indeed, in 1922, a number of families were forcibly expelled from the nearby Monaghan village of Glasslough. And similarly, Catholic families were expelled from Tyrone as well. But there is a rawness there in terms of people who feel that, you know, we have left the South, we've left just County Monaghan, this is all we have now. And so, yes, there is sectarianism, there is discrimination, but it has its origins in a longer conflict. And I think that it is important. It is important not to miss that. So when Curry sort of, when they, you know, break into the house in Kinnear Terrace, part of the reason that they're so angry about the house, which should have been, in their view, of course, allocated to a large Catholic family instead of a single Protestant woman who is from Northern Ireland, but is marrying a Protestant from County Monaghan, who's going to move to Northern Ireland to take up this public housing, take up this house funded by the state. And so the Monaghan aspect of this is important, and it tends to get, it has largely been overlooked. But it is something at the time that the civil rights movement in places like Tyrone and Fermanagh very much highlighted. And so it added to the tensions and indeed affected the Protestant community, of course, in the three counties as well.
Is it fair to say that what begins as a civil rights movement gets co-opted and becomes like a guerrilla war?
Well, I think elements of it, of course, the civil rights movement breaks into very different political streams. So you have people who stick closely to the Social Democratic and Labour Party, and ultimately this moderate, peaceful political party. And then from the start, of course, you've got people like Kevin Mallon in Tyrone, who's a dynamic member of the civil rights movement, but is, of course, also a leading Republican who plays a very prominent role in the Republican war against the British state then for the next number of years. So it's, you have an IRA element within the civil rights movement from the start, who are always looking for this as a vehicle for confrontation with the British state and ultimately a violent struggle against the British state to unify the island of Ireland. And that's part of the issue. Even in Caledon, you've got Austin Curry, who's SDLP, but you also have, he's there with Patsy Gilderney, who's clearly Sinn Féin, a Republican. And so that feeds Protestant, Unionist suspicion, of course, that this is not just a Pacific movement.
So just about every example of memory that we've discussed so far has been negative, has been past grievances that inflame relations between communities, that make innocent people victims of violence. But you end your book talking about how memories connected to people from these lost counties, and I'm thinking of Tony Blair in particular, are also tied into the Good Friday Agreement, that there's political capital there in that past and the memories of that past that help end the violence. So how does that work?
Yeah, I think in Blair's case, Blair in some ways, Blair's mother was, of course, had this, Ulster loyalist background from County Donegal. His family had actually been attacked by the IRA near the town of Ballyshannon, sort of in the Donegal hills of the hills of South Donegal. And he in later years, when he came to know his Donegal family, in some ways it's not positive, because I think he was sort of quite repelled by the sectarianism that he encountered among his own family. Now, I think there are many people in Donegal, including his family, who feel that is not an accurate description of the Corscadden family. So, there is tension there that should be acknowledged. But I think it drove him in a way to take a real interest in Irish affairs. And it drove him to, I think, think more carefully about how to end that sort of sense of bitterness and resentment that he had, an innate understanding of some of the tensions that were at play there, even among a family who had been in some ways perhaps one of the reasons his mother's family were aggrieved was because they had, of course, been left behind the border, that they were committed Ulster Unionists. And so I think it certainly informed his thinking very early on. And I don't believe that Tony Blair, who was sometimes not known for remaining focused for a long period on a single issue, of course, that's perhaps the nature of premiership, of being Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. But he did very much focus on getting the Good Friday Agreement, on getting Northern Ireland to a better place. And I think Blair deserves credit for that. Whatever about anything else in his premiership, that is something that we should always recall, that he deserves enormous credit for the amount of focus, attention he put on Northern Ireland. And of course, Ian Paisley was pivotal ultimately. I mean, Blair did establish a working relationship with Ian Paisley, who was the kind of the never, the anti-Good Friday Agreement, anti anti-peace kind of negotiations of 1998, that Blair ultimately did persuade him to embrace power sharing, and Paisley went on to be a first minister in Northern Ireland before his death, and, you know, worked alongside Sinn Féin, and serving government alongside Sinn Féin. And, you know, Blair basically always said that one of the only reasons he trusted Blair was because Blair got Ulster, i.e. Blair's mother's family were a very important aspect. His knowledge, his understanding, and his heritage for Paisley was important. I think other unionists viewed him more skeptically, but ultimately that's, if we take Paisley's word, you know, for why he listened to Blair, then the Donegal connection was important to him.
So it could have been beneficial cultural capital that he had that past.
I think so. I think in Paisley's case, yes. And he understood. He understood the Orange Order. He understood Ulster Unionism. He didn't like it. And I think he may have been, you know, not, certainly he was not generous to his mother's family in his memoirs. But I think it helped in terms of those crucial years from 1998 to 2007.
And one question I can't help asking is, so if these lost counties get left out because you want to reinforce the Protestant majority in Ulster. And in the 1920s, it's about, 63% or something around there versus 30% of Catholics. And you fast forward to the present day, Catholics now outnumber Protestants in Ulster, from what I've read.
That's right. In the 90s.
The equation, I mean, how does that upend everything?
So I think, well, this has always been the problem for Ulster Unionism, that having that inherent Protestantism within this identity. And look, this is not necessarily unique in the world. I mean, you know, if you talk a bit to Serbs, they will say that, you know, without Orthodox Christianity, you know, they don't really, that's a core defining aspect of Serbian national identity. So I think, you know, we can't be too hard in terms of saying that, you know, just because they have a religious aspect to a kind of a national identity or a sense of ethnos, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, mean that it is just completely, it should be instantly dismissed. But I think, of course, you know, being on the island of Ireland and being trying to hold one province, you know, in terms of a national movement from O'Connell onwards was always going to be difficult. I think the problem is that they've you know, whenever they've tried to broaden an Ulster identity to include you know, people from a Catholic background, for example, that has really never gained much traction. And then, you know, ultimately they went down a route which stressed, because in some ways they had to justify a secession of a part of the island of Ireland in terms of the Government of Ireland Act in 1920. And the easiest thing to do was to talk up the differences of Ulster and perhaps not emphasize, let's say, an Irish identity within the wider United Kingdom. And so by making that choice in the early 20th century, they have ultimately limited the attraction of unionism to people from a not a Protestant background. And there were people who, you know, Jack Gorman, who was a prominent, whose family had a long police service, and he originally came from the south of Ireland in County Tipperary. You know, he was a unionist, but he really did not like Ulster unionism. He always felt that he was actually in charge of the Housing Commission in the 1970s and was a sort of, you know, much respected, you know, sort of senior official in Northern Ireland. But he always said that, you know, the mistake of unionism in the north of Ireland was that it never emphasizes Britishness enough, and that actually you could have attracted, that there were many Catholics, many people in Ireland who were sympathetic to a British identity, but that moment had been lost. And I think Jack Gorman, I think that assessment is right, that, you know, in the early 20th century, there were, you know, at the start of the 20th century, there were quite a significant number of nationalists who were happy with a devolution settlement that wouldn't be dissimilar to what Scotland has now. And independence was not necessarily, you know, did not enjoy sort of overwhelming support at the start of the 20th century. It was more about sort of trying to have an Irish nation within a wider empire, which is something was emphasized by John Redmond and Irish Parliamentary Party leaders. So Ulster Unionists, you know, that they went down a track that was about emphasizing Protestantism as a qualification of Ulsterness. And that is something that in today's Northern Ireland just cannot work in the 21st century to keep Northern Ireland secure in the Union. And yet they still haven't quite got there in terms of moving beyond that. There is not a, you know, the Orange Order tends to be still at the vanguard of kind of the type of Northern Irishness that the DUP expresses, the Democratic Unionist Party, which is the largest unionist party. And that is, of course, is an exclusively Protestant organization. I mean, that's, you know, it's got a religious element to it, and it's got so, but now, of course, it has a political element. So they have not been able to shift unionism into a truly Northern Irish unionism away from an Ulster unionism. And so that is a massive dilemma for those whose primary interest is securing the future of Northern Ireland within the union of the within the United Kingdom.
Ed, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Ed Burke is an assistant professor of war since 1945 at University College Dublin. I've been talking with him about his book, Ulster's Lost Counties, Loyalism and Paramilitarism Since 1920. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.